Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Our weekly conversations always include you. And if you'd like to join us anytime during the program, the phone lines are open. 941-3689 is the number if you call us from Oahu and from the neighbor islands. Or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else, you can get to us at 877-941-3689. Few of us truly know what it's like to be homeless. Fewer still would choose to be homeless for the lesson of it. That would not describe my guest tonight. Reverend Lorenza Andrade Smith is an ordained United Methodist minister who took her decision to live simply and put it into action. She spent the past 4 years living with the poor, the marginalized, and the homeless. She lived for 3 years in the United States, under the stars, as she puts it, from California to New York, Illinois to Texas, and many, many places in between. For the past year, she's been on a global journey. She's been homeless in Israel, Australia, Guatemala, Italy, Russia, Iceland, Vietnam, and India, and even more countries that are in that list. For the past few weeks, actually about the past 10 days or so, she's been in Hawaii to consider the plight of the homeless here, and we'll speak about her travels and observations this weekend, and she's with us tonight on Town Square. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Reverend Andrade Smith, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Most people, when they hear a story like yours, come across with a one-word question. Why?
Well, I feel this was a calling, not only from God, but from my church and my community. And so I chose to answer that call. And it was a difficult decision. It was a long decision. It was a prayerful decision. But at the end, I feel that God put me in the place I needed to be at this time.
You had been with a congregation.
Yes, in San Antonio, Texas.
And when this idea came to you, it came out of the congregation, or what brought this to you?
Well, I was serving a congregation in San Antonio, Texas. Prior to being clergy, I had always had the opportunity to house people. And when I became clergy, there was a situation on a New Year's Eve where there was a gentleman who needed help, very sick. And so I brought him into our parsonage, and as courtesy, went to the congregation to let them know that someone was staying in the parsonage with me. And they said, absolutely not. They started talking about liability issues. I was a woman. He was a man. And without any anger or anything, I abided by their request, and I took the man back to the streets. And the very thing that had brought me into ministry as a layperson, now as a clergy person, I was unable to do, house someone in need. And so I went to my bishop and said, if the church does not welcome the poor, I would like to go to the poor, have the church go to the poor. And of course, my bishop said, absolutely not. And it took a year and a half to negotiate, and finally I was appointed to the streets.
How did all of this affect your relationship with your congregation?
I had a very good relationship with the congregation. Again, this was a year and a half negotiation. I don't think there was any intentionality of any harm, neither from the congregation towards me or me towards the congregation. This was just something that came from the situation. The congregation is very loving. I continue to visit. My son is still a member from that congregation. And so there's much support. But again, it's just something that I felt called to, and I felt that I needed to be there at that time.
Everyone has just heard you say, yes, my son is still a member of that congregation. How does your son deal with the fact that mom may be any place on the planet?
Well, my son, as well as my family, are very supportive. And my son is married to a woman from the congregation, and I have a new grandson. And he is, and just to point out also, he is Muslim, attending a Christian church. And so the complexities of all of that continue. But my family is just very supportive, and so there's not this great fear or anxiety about it, but some prayer and support.
And you check in regularly when you can?
As soon as I approached Hawaii and I was on U.S. calls, I sure did. I called and we talked and we had a good conversation, and I will be seeing them again in July. So I'm looking forward to that.
In between now and then, you're still going to continue your journey, but let's talk a little bit about what that journey has looked like over these last 4 years. Did you have a sense of where you needed to go? Obviously, you started in Texas because Texas was where you were, but how did you go, or how did you find yourself being drawn from place to place?
The idea where invitations happen, I go where I'm invited at times, and I was invited to start in Australia and then move to India to work in the brickyards. And so I was there for 2 months, and then I continued journeying. And so a lot of times those are based on invitations. When there's not an invitation, I just see where my feet take me and where the Lord and the Spirit guide me. So the circumstances are always different, bringing me to Hawaii were the Brit lectures. And so they brought me from Israel to Hawaii, and from here I go to Spain to do El Camino de Santiago, since I'm trying to continue on a contemplative pilgrimage.
When you say that you have invitations, what exactly do you mean? Because there may be some confusion with the idea that you truly do live on the streets. That's what you do. But when you're invited into a community, how do those two things sync up?
Well, the ministry, my original appointment was ministry with the poor and marginalized, advocating for systemic change. And in solidarity, I gave up my compensation, medical benefits, and pension. And so the advocating piece is important to me. I'm not just going away in this isolated world to pray and get away from it all, but to be in the world and to try to make a difference. And so if there's a need for advocacy, I certainly accept that invitation, because I think that is one of the purposes of this mission.
Let's talk about some of your advocacy that you've done while you've been on this journey, and what that advocacy looks like from place to place. Are a lot of the ordinances that you see and a lot of the same issues consistent with each other, or have certain places managed to cope with the issue of homelessness better than other places?
Well, and I'll use the term homeless in quotes.
And I know you don't like
that usually
term.
I say I live under the stars. Homeless just seems to be a less than situation, but I'll be using that in quotes. I think it's very contextual. Those that you see on the streets in India, for example, is very different than those you see on the streets in Greenland and China or Russia. And so I think ordinances are sometimes very clear, written, proposed, legislated, followed in some countries, but not in others. And so I see many tourist places with strong ordinances, of course, being advocated by the business community, and then those opposed to it trying to do some community efforts to relieve some of those people on the streets. I understand there needs to be some sort of compromise and work so that something healthy comes from it. But certainly there is absolute ordinance many places. I've been to jail about 4 times now with different advocacy pieces, and one of those is protesting the criminalization of the poor.
Where were you in jail?
My time in jail has been in San Antonio, Texas. My ministry is with the poor and marginalized. Not all marginalized are poor, and not all ministry focused is on the homeless. And so I've done some work with immigration protests there, where I've been arrested and also just merely in the process of getting a ticket for sleeping on a bench. And I've been in jail for that twice, and another one for organizing with workers.
When you were arrested and spent time in jail in San Antonio, that was your home turf. How did that go over with your congregation and people who knew you? And did other people also realize that you were clergy?
Well, my first arrest, definitely I was very visible as a clergy. And I received much support. It was with the Dreamers, and so there was much community support. Of course, there were those that have some issue with seeing clergy in the midst of this, but I believe that is our living out our call, living into the gospel, embodying the gospel with our own, with our bodies. And so it was a process for me that was, I think, gave voice to those who might not had a seat at the table. And a lot of the objective is just to have a give people a place at the table so that they can have some influence in what's going on in their world, in their life.
Did your former congregation realize that? Did they really see that that was what you were trying to do? Or did some of them come up to you and say, Reverend Andrade Smith, what are you doing?
Oh, I had a little bit of both, of course. But for the most part, I had very good supportive system. They found people for the pulpit. And they continue to support me and follow me on Facebook. And I just continue to pray for the congregation as well. I think also I work a lot with not only the congregations, but the community and the grassroots community. But I also work, I have very good relationships with the police department as well. I was doing my job as a clergy and person of faith, and they were doing their job, and I was breaking ordinance, and I accept that consequence when I do break the ordinance or the laws. But not all law is just law. And so I also try to make changes in those laws. And so, again, a relationship even with the mayor and city council people, it was very good. They understood what I was doing, yet there was a process that we needed to go through.
If you've just joined us tonight on Town Square, we're talking with Reverend Lorenza Andrade Smith. She is an ordained United Methodist minister. She took her decision to live simply, and she put it into action. For the last 4 years, she has been living pretty much outside, all over the United States and all over the world. We're talking about her travels tonight and some of her observations and what she brings to Hawaii as she's here to speak this weekend. She's been here for a little while now, taking a look at different communities, and we're going to be talking to her about those in just a moment. If you have a question or a comment and you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. You might not take this journey, but I bet you have a question for someone who has, and we'd like to hear from you. You mentioned a little while ago that when you see people who are on the street in China, it's very different than people who are on the street in India and people who are on the street in Hawaii or people on the street in pick a city. When you see those differences and you have to adjust to them fairly quickly, have you gotten into situations where you really didn't know what you were up against?
Well, certainly when I enter a country or a different city, I don't know the local ordinances or laws, and I rely on those who live on the streets to help me. Even here in Hawaii, I entered without really understanding the context, and so certainly there's a level of learning, and that's part of the ministry. I'm really, we joke around, I'm appointed to do nothing but communicate the love of God, and I do that by being present, listening, and learning. And so that's one of the goals, is to learn. And I do that by listening to my neighbors who live on the streets, who have kept me alive. They are the ones that have provided me with hospitality. So certainly the context is very different in different locations. Greenland, people don't own the land. And so there's still an acceptance of living outside, because that's the way the people lived a long time ago. But yet I couldn't enter the shelters because I was not Greenlandic or Danish. I was a U.S. citizen. And so I was, I'm in Greenland, which is can be very cold, and unable to enter the shelters. And so standing up in that kind of situation is unique. And then I have to modify and learn how to survive.
Even when you don't speak the language?
Even when I don't speak the language. China and Russia were very difficult. And also, I've learned that a lot of the poverty-stricken areas in rural areas don't have the second or third or fourth languages, and English is often not one of those. So
how do you find people then who, as you say, keep you alive? Because we hear that from people in this community very frequently, that they want to choose where they want to be because they trust certain people and they are distrustful of others, or they may not want to go to a shelter because they feel like they don't, you know, really have great faith in what may happen there. We hear those kinds of stories, but most people here speak the same language. But when you are in the places that you've been and you haven't been able to really communicate that, how do you find people who have been able to keep you alive?
Well, I think I do have a faith in God that, though I don't have the theology that God protects me, but God is with me. And so whatever happens, I think I've already come to terms with that. I'm prepared for anything, but understanding that God is with me makes the world a difference. The language barrier, you know, there's always body language. And the very basics of life, of needing to eat, finding a place to relieve oneself, where to sleep. There are very basic ideas that you can communicate. In India, for example, there was little to no language communication as far as voice language, but the body language was very helpful. I lived in the very poorest areas of brickyards where immigrants would come in to work in servitude, basically, because they were not given enough money to make bricks. So they were given loans to stay where, in shelter, unable to repay the loan, so they'd have to come back season after season. And so just the provision of food, provision of shelter in the very meager means meant the world to me, especially the provision of water, clean water to drink. And so they provided that, their hospitality, and I worked alongside with them making bricks.
You say, too, that you are prepared for anything. Anything meaning anything, meaning that you could be attacked or even killed.
Certainly, that was something I had to think about. For those viewers that can't, or listeners that can't see me, I'm a 4'11 Latina, and so I don't have this this empowering statue. But it's something that most people would say, you don't belong on the streets. And there are use of drugs, people that are alcoholics, mental illness. You're in alleys, you're behind retails, you're by garbage, you're under the bridges. So you never know what's going to happen. I just decided I would be prepared for anything, including death. In First John, it talks about laying your life down for one another.
When you talk about that in those terms, and also the fact that your family is reconciled to how you're doing your life, how you're living your life, how do you also see this translating back into a life where you can continue to make a difference if you continually put yourself in harm's way, potentially? How do you reconcile those two things without saying, yes, it's all, yeah, I put my faith in God and I'm fully expect that I'll be able to do this, but still, do you have a sense of, well, I'll go there, but I won't go over there? Is there any sense of balance that you strike or boundaries that you create to be able to keep your mission going by keeping yourself alive?
Well, I think certainly I often hear, especially from people on the streets, you know, there's a culture also, and there's a hierarchy, and often I run into folks on the streets that tell me, oh, don't go in there, those are the heroin addicts, or that's the gang area. And certainly that's going to be the first place I go. I'm in solidarity with the least of these, and it's the least of these even within the community of the least of these. And so there's always tension there as well. People on the streets are trying to also protect me. And I certainly am prudent about things. I mean, two nights ago, there was some folks with knives on the street and some fighting. And I certainly didn't try to get in the middle of it. By the time things were exhausted, I did approach them and asked if they needed some prayer. And that was welcomed. So I do try to be prudent and try to exercise some judgment, good judgment. But that won't keep me from going to my brothers and sisters who are in need.
Let's talk about when you arrived in Hawaii. Because here you are at the invitation of the church here. You're going to be speaking this weekend. And they said, we'll come pick you up. And you said...
Well, certainly, out of hospitality, they wanted to, of course, offer me pickup and hotels and all that. So I just asked if I could have 3 days prior to meeting with church folks. So I walked from the airport and walked along and met up quite quickly with folks who were living under the bridges and then walked over to Sand Island. And stayed there for my first night. And then from there, walked down to the Waikiki Beach to see the situation. And then went to Waianae. And then came back to the canal area by the community college.
All of this on your own? Or were you being shepherded by some of the people that you met?
No, the first couple of nights were on my own. And then I was asked to go to Waianae to... visit the situation there. And so I did receive a ride. That was kind of a spontaneous thing, same day, same hour, actually, that I was asked. And I said, sure, since I really have no agenda. And so I went out to the Waianae area and stayed outside with some families at a church who has pews outside, pastored by Pastor Deborah. And so I met some families there, and we had great conversation. Which unfortunately, one of a mother of five is now in the hospital in Waiuhu, I believe it is. And so I went to make a hospital visitation yesterday.
As you're here and now talking with families here and talking with people on the street, and you've had time to really see some of these neighborhoods up close, if maybe not for a protracted period of time, certainly a dedicated period of time. Is there something about what you see in Hawaii that strikes you as being different from what you have seen in other cities throughout the U.S. where you have also spent time and other places around the world?
Yeah, one of the things that really caught my eye was here in the area, I see families, many families, many children. And so, for example, in Texas, if Child Protective Services would see any child on the street, they would certainly pick them in and take them into case management. And so this is something that really struck my eye, and I'm still really reflecting on that. Certainly we don't want to divide families, and we also don't want to see children on the street. And so that's really something that really I've been giving thought to.
What have you seen in other places, aside from Texas, where you say, you know, the families go off and sometimes will secret themselves so that Child Protective Services doesn't see a child in the middle of the day and scoop up that child?
Sure. I in California, suburban areas, there's some wooded places, and I went in there, and not 100 feet into the wooded areas, there's a tent with a family, you know, probably a 5-6-year-old blonde little girl playing in her yard around her tent. And so they try to stay hidden in the woods so that they could keep family together. Often shelters, depending on the city, often shelters do not have the facilities to keep families together. They'll separate the father or the mother with the children. And so that it's a concern for families. It's a concern for me. But the main concern is these children are seeing this as a normalcy. And so how is it that they're growing up? What is their context? What is their norm?
As you reflect on that and really look at the normalcy that a child would know based on its own experience, you've done this for a while. You've seen kids over, you know, some period of time. Have you begun to answer that at all? Have you found any answers to how these children process this as they've gotten a little bit older?
No, I certainly don't have an answer to that. But I do know there's a research article talks about how poverty taxes the brain. I received it from a professor from Bluffton University in Ohio. I'm not sure exactly where she started it. And this speaks to how it changes your cognitive thinking, very similar to that, parallel to that of a chronic alcoholic. And so that cognitive process, I think, and this is just tested in adults, but I would suspect that with children, it is also there. And so their schooling, for example, or even their social behaviors with other children could be a change there.
If you're just joining us tonight, we're visiting with Reverend Lorenza Andrade Smith. She is an ordained United Methodist minister. She decided to take her desire to live simply, her decision to do that, and put it into action by walking out into the world, literally. And for the last 4 years, she's been walking around the country, walking around the world in many, many countries around the globe and in many states. She's here in Hawaii. She'll be speaking this weekend. And tonight we're talking to her about some of her, I won't call them exactly adventures, but it has been a journey. And if you have a question, it's probably not a journey that you would take. But we have someone in our studio who has chosen to do this and has some distinct viewpoints on homelessness and living with the poor. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. You guys are all really quiet tonight. Maybe all of this is just a whole lot to take in. And as you talk to so many people and get invitations to speak different places now, do you see an end to this coming anytime soon that you maybe will want to return to being with a congregation or having a different life and can serve people differently than you have been over these last 4 years?
Well, the initial appointment was 3 years, and then I asked for an extension to reflect. I was so engaged in just survival, everyday survival, that I needed some time to really do some reflection. And so I asked for another year, and this is this year of contemplative pilgrimage. So this year ends July 1st, and that's when my bishop from the San Antonio area will appoint me to a different ministry. Most likely it will be another congregation. And so I'm looking forward to that, but at the same time, I'm also still grappling with the idea of how to move into that space, that new space.
With your desire to do as much advocacy that has gotten you into jail and into trouble on occasion, and into places that most of us will never, ever see. Is that possible for you to reconcile that, or you don't really know yet until you're in the situation where you have a new congregation and it's tested?
Yes, certainly you enter a congregation and you listen and you hear the direction that they would like to take, and you try to live your faith together and in community. And so I'm not going to have a personal agenda as I move in. This is about the community, and so I'll have to wait to see what community I get appointed to, and then we'll move from there and see what the issues in the community are, and see where we can live into the gospel in that community.
Might that mean that your activism would come to an end, or your advocacy for people who are marginalized would come to an end?
Oh, the poor and marginalized are everywhere. We're everywhere. So I don't know that would ever come to an end. We're trying to live into a better space in this world, in this community. And so there's always something to continue to journey in the gospel. And so I just look forward to that.
All right. Well, we've got some callers on the line who would now like to talk to you. Michael calling us from Wailuku. Aloha, Michael. Welcome to Town Square.
Hello, are you there?
We're right here, yes.
I have been homeless, and the reason I was homeless is because my ex-wife, who's seriously mentally ill, swore out a temporary restraining order, and when I showed up in court after 2 weeks of being homeless and having nowhere to turn and getting no advice and no help from anyone, I was denied due process by the judge in the court. And so I've lost my home, I lost all of my possessions, I lost everything. And the big problem is that nobody really cares. It's a culture of persecution and punishment rather than a culture of encouragement and support and rehabilitation. The prisons are a bastion of vicious exploitation and abuse, and the streets are, again, pretty much the same way. There are so many different organizations that have no coordination whatsoever between them, so many government agencies that have no communication or coordination between them. They often work at odds with each other, and more often than not, give wrong advice. They send you to the wrong places. They
Michael, have you had forms? Can you stop for a second? I just want to ask you. Have you had people tell you? I mean, very recently, tell you information that turned out to be untrue.
Yeah, that's why I ended up homeless. Is because I could not get any legal representation in any way, shape, or form. The public defender threw me out. They don't deal with that. The Legal Aid Society doesn't deal with that. Volunteer Legal Services, the advice I got from Volunteer Legal Services was shave, dress nice, and treat the court like a church. That was it. I needed legal representation.
Well, I'm sorry that you have had the experiences that you've had. Did you have a question for Reverend Andrade Smith?
No, I was just complaining. I managed to pull through. I now have a place that takes almost all of my Social Security money. Can't get help with finding other housing. My question to her is, when is she going to plunk herself down in one place and make a difference in that one place and inspire others to do the same?
All right,
thank you. She's learned a great deal, and she's highly admirable. It's just amazing the risks that she's encountered to find out all of the information that she's found. I hope and pray that she will find a way to pick one place and make it better, and hopefully inspire others to let it grow from there. Because
Michael,
lack of coordination and communication and the culture of persecution that keeps the homeless homeless and the mentally ill mentally ill.
All right, well, let's have her answer you then. He's had quite an experience of his own, and we don't have particulars on that, certainly, so it's very hard to talk about that situation. But his point is, instead of going everywhere and just trying to experience and see, is it time to settle down and try to take those experiences and do something with them? Now, obviously, you're going to be given a congregation sometime in the near future. But again, that kind of goes back to my question to you of how do you take all this and what Michael is asking, make it meaningful and do something with it?
Sure. Well, the first appointment intentionally was to remain in San Antonio, Texas. I had no intention whatsoever to move around. That, again, it came from invitations, and then the churches wanted me to talk to their congregations, Rotary clubs, high schools. And so I had to really, really struggle with that. And again, because of the advocacy piece, advocating for systemic change, I decided that it was important to be able to share the story in those different locations so that they can get involved in those locations. I'm one person. I'm there to be present, listen, and learn. If it influences a congregation or community to do something, then there needs to be work on the ground in that community. It won't revolve around me. I'm not that powerful. You know, there's that thing. It is about your community. Your community needs to take action. I hope I can give some sort of voice to it, but I don't feel called to take charge or lead anything.
As you see that systemic change, what precisely would you like to have happen to change the system?
Well, I think first we need to look at poverty. Poverty, I think, is a euphemism, and we hide behind poverty. What is poverty? What does that mean when you're going to the state capital or your local council or the federal Congress to look at issues? In essence, it turns out to be we need access to education, to health, to things of that nature that do broader well-being to communities. I also wanted to point out that my experience has been I have a projection. People project anger on me quite often. The church projects anger on me because I work with the very poor who don't get off their butts to go to work. Or at least sometimes that's the perspective, saying they offer them help, but they don't want to help themselves. And then I get the anger projected on me by those who live on the streets because I work with a church who feel that they're a world of hypocrisy, which say they're going to help the poor, but at the end they just kind of scorn the poor. And so I live with this projection of anger from both worlds. And so it's been an interesting time to see why is the church so angry with the poor, or the community so angry with the poor, and why is the poor so angry with the church and the community? And so that's been an interesting journey as I've walked around the world.
What in some ways was the reason that you had this whole journey with the story that you told us a little while ago about the homeless man that you wanted to bring into the parsonage and church folks said no and you had to return him to the street?
Right. Just in that small story, there's tension, great tension. Now, the rest of that story was this gentleman, though the church rejected this gentleman, the gentleman did not reject the church. He became a member of that church. And to this day, five years later, he goes to every Bible study, every church service. He sings solos. And I think the vote would be very vastly different. They certainly, I think anyone in that committee would take him in to their own home because they got to know him and they know his name. And I think we need to build relationships with people rather than treat them as an issue or a problem. This is a humanitarian issue.
We have many callers now on the line who want to talk to you. We're going to go now to Michael calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Michael. Thanks for your patience.
Hello.
Hi there.
My name's Michael. I live on the Big Island. And I really, what the lady was just saying, I really agree with that about how the churches think the poor don't want to work and the poor people think the church doesn't want to help them. What I called originally is because you were talking about the kids that are raised in poverty. I came from really hard times. My mom was raised on the street. I'd been raised in, like, if CPS would have came in when I was a kid, I would have got taken away.
Was that here, Michael?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Was that here that you were raised in Hawaii?
Yeah, I was raised in Hawaii, and I really feel that keeping the family together is very important. No matter how poor, if they're homeless, keeping the family together is very important. And I was raised super poor. I've climbed out of the hole. This is the first year I'm actually going to have to pay taxes. So I'm pretty proud of that, and I actually have the money to do it. But I wouldn't have gotten here without the help of the community. And if I would have got separated from my family, I don't know what would have happened. So the reason I'm calling is that no matter how homeless or how destitute, it's very important to keep the family together.
Well, Michael, we think it's wonderful that you've been able to make your life into the state that it's in now and to be happy that you can pay taxes. Boy, that's a lesson for a lot of us. Thanks a whole lot for your call.
The lady, keep up the good work.
Thank you, Michael. God bless you.
Going now to Sachi, also calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Sachi. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. I just wanted to, I just have something to tell your guest. I lived, when I was a child, I was abandoned quite a bit by my mother with five younger brothers and sisters. And I had to sort of do everything myself. I had to figure everything out on my own. The reason I'm calling is because My husband recently died, very recently, and I had a kind of a phenomenal experience, and it was my car was surrounded by butterflies, and I couldn't figure it out. I drove all the way down to the beach, and then my car was again surrounded by butterflies, and I had this very clear kind of a, I don't know how to explain it, but it was sort of a message, and it was, you know, your definition of God is too puny. If you don't put in all the things that you need, which are protection and all the things that you would like it to be, then you're really demeaning the concept of what it is. It's less than omnipotent. If you don't say, "Protect, please protect me," and actually, you know, not only ask for it, but demand it and ask for guidance and proof, you know, proof of life. And I did that, and I had a pretty phenomenal experience. And I had some roses that sprout on a rose bush that, from putting too little, I was very, very depressed, and I put, because the rose bush has never had roses, and I put two silk roses on the rose bush one day, and 2 weeks later, I walked out there, and there were two identical roses, exactly the same shape and color as these silk roses, and it was a validation to me that what you're doing is a calling, and you are homeless, and you are being protected, and you are showing what poverty is, and you are, like, the only person I have ever met that's doing what you're doing are Tibetan Buddhist priests that walk barefoot in the snow, or Zen priests.
Forgive me for interrupting you, but we have other callers that I want to make sure can talk with her, too. But thank you very much for calling with your story, and so sorry for your loss of your husband. Going now to Sina calling us from Waikiki. Aloha, Sina. Welcome to Town Square.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I didn't get to hear all of the Reverend's testimony, but I really appreciate the bearing witness that you're doing. And your sense of solidarity with the least of these really speaks to me. I stayed at IHS, which is our probably our largest emergency shelter, for a year, 2 years ago. And I'm a believer. I was raised in the church, and it was interesting because many people who came to volunteer were deeply spiritual, religious, loving people who, because they didn't live with us, had no idea how dehumanizing that experience was. And I often longed for a burqa that I could wear that would say courtesy of IHS, when they would just have the Japanese Chamber of Commerce or people come in and it was like they were told, don't make eye contact with the homeless for our protection or theirs, who knows. And people at my church who would give and think they were doing God's work by supporting the shelter, which they were helping in a lot of ways. I've never been courageous to go outside homeless, but I don't want anyone to go through that experience. There are many things I could tell you, but I won't. But how do you respond to the dehumanization that sometimes the church's good intentions can have?
That's a good question. That's a good question, and I think I'd like to have Reverend Andrade Smith answer you for that one. And thank you so much, Sina, for calling with it. She speaks to some of what you've been talking about with us this hour that you've experienced from time to time with the anger coming at you and getting it from both ends.
Sure. And I think I always point out that I'm in ministry with rather than ministry to. And that helps us. We're both the giver and the receiver. There's a mutuality that promotes human dignity. None of us have the answer, but if we work together with the business people, with those who live under the stars, with the church and the community, and we begin to listen to one another, I think that will make a positive change. We can make lots of changes. They're not always the right changes. We need to make transformation that is for the well-being of the people, for the whole community, for the business person, and for the homeless person. And so I really believe that human dignity is you know, it always says it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. And walking with one another is giving human dignity. And so we need to learn to be in ministry with, be receivers and givers. And that includes a lot of listening time. It's harder than we think to do nothing. We're always about doing, but that doing often gets in the way of communicating the love of God.
When you speak to the business community specifically, when the business community is charged with making a profit, keeping the business going, keeping the doors open, making sure that people have access, being able to market effectively, all the things that you know, because once upon a time you told me you were in business too. How do you talk to them and involve them in this process in a way that you think perhaps we haven't done so well? And certainly as you've been walking around Chinatown and you see some of what it looks like there and what some of the business owners have said, how do you approach them?
Profit is not always about monetary profit. And so we have to look at that. Every good business person has gone through their business school and their business ethics as well. And so the idea that profit can be in giving back to the community where there's a well-being of all people, which in turn will give wealth back into the community. And so that's a very, I think businesses are looking very short-term rather than long-term. And so profits, short-term profit is more important than long-term well-being of the company at times.
Well, if you're talking about a bigger company, I mean, there are big companies, and then there are very small businesses, some of which you've seen when you've been walking around Chinatown. And I just keep picking on that
because
you hear a lot from those folks who say, you know, when you have somebody right there in front of your door or you have to step over all kinds of stuff to be able to get into the door, that's not really conducive to business.
Sure. And that small business can help advocate for housing first. Let's get those on the streets in a home so they're not in front of your business.
All right. We're going to take a few more calls before the hour is up. Now, Margaret calling us from Waikiki. By the way, if you'd like to be next, the number to call us if you're on Oahu is 941-3689. Or if you're calling us from the neighbor islands or listening to the live stream, our number is 877-941-3689. Aloha, Margaret. Welcome to Town Square.
Oh, hi. She is a profound lady that you got there. There's not too many people, like the other caller said, that would do something like that. I mean, just to voluntarily be out and understand and see what you can do and go where God places you or where you're called. I was homeless for 2 years recently and then 3 years pretty much waiting and being on a list, but being in a group house and going in. I'm just now into federal housing, and I love it. It's just been a walk, and you have to keep persevering when you're homeless. You just cannot give up. I almost did. I got all my things stolen, my identity and things like that, like in my bag, my main bag that was with me, and I just broke down. And I tell you, the first step, here, let me tell you, in Hawaii, there's so much aloha. That other man, people have different experiences. But I chose to be alone pretty much with my little bird. I have a little bird that I loved, and she's been with me for when I was evicted and everything. And I chose to be up in a nest area, and I'd have to get out 5:30 in the morning and be there by 6:30 at night just so that I wouldn't be tagged and be in jail. And The police got me more time. But anyway, the main thing is that I found so much aloha. Going to my doctor, I chose Waikiki Health Center because I was in Waikiki homeless. And I stayed. I remember they were the main support. I'd be out there early in the morning, and then I'd be getting my appointment. And then people told me, call the access line. And if you have any type of depression or mental, and usually when you're living outside, it's hard not to be depressed. You're just surviving, you know. You're just trying to meet the next day. Do you have compact things? Are you going to get wet? Are you tucked in? Are you safe? You know, so many things going on your plate.
And Margaret, I think you're absolutely right. I had never experienced exhaustion like I had experienced on the streets. And that perseverance that you're speaking of is so important. I find my breaking point every 3 months, and I have this, unfortunately, a privilege where I can come in every 3 months and come indoors to have a meal, to have a bed. But I really think that we don't really understand the implications of exhaustion, of maybe not eating right, not the right hygiene and all. So well, I think thank you, Margaret, for your witness.
One of the things that has come out in recent months is, and that we've talked about this on the morning show, on the conversation and on Town Square, is that people don't live very long when they're on the streets. Average age is about 50 years old. Far, far greater mortality than what we would normally expect in this day and age because of some of what you've talked about, what Margaret has talked about too. For those people who are still on the street who have to deal with now sit-lie laws, knowing that if you know they get their things confiscated, it may take them $1,000, which they surely don't have, to be able to get it back. These laws are not unlike situations that you have seen elsewhere. As you put Hawaii into the context of all of those places with some of those ordinances and the great exhaustion that you feel in trying to move through them or do what you have to do to be able to avoid them, is there any place that seemingly gets more of it right than we do?
I don't know that we can really address the issue of that exhaustion, of that health issue, when someone lives on the streets or who's homeless. Unfortunately, I've had to experience it firsthand. I've done memorial services. You're absolutely right. Average life between 42 and 52. And so I've done memorial services at the end of the year for a city, San Antonio, and average age was 46. 66 people had died on the streets. And that was the average age. And so that's a reality, one that we have not been able to, I don't think, do any better. I haven't seen that. I haven't been able to experience that any differently anywhere we are, anywhere I've been.
All right. Well, let's see what we hear from Jane calling us on the Big Island, from the Big Island. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you for having this show, and I hope that I've had enough time to get the emotion out of my voice, because I just would like to say these things to our guest speaker and our community, our island community, our world community. What is homelessness versus houselessness? Isn't home where the heart is? Everybody needs a safe place to pitch a tent with water facilities. What is the best model that all the people you meet have shared ideas and you've seen which one is best? How about a sort of nonprofit gardening yurt, self-run safe halfway house for all men, families, mothers with children, huts with county septic garbage service, responsibility, integrity, honor.
Jane, I know this is really difficult for you. We can hear that in your voice, but let me ask that of Reverend Andrade Smith and see if we can get some answers, because there are certain places around the country. I'm thinking of Portland, other places where there are areas which are designated, if not safe zones, but small communities where some of the things she's describing actually happen. What have you seen as you have been out in the world and running around in your way to see how people live when they are at that level?
Well, you know, there are communities where, for example, city council passes a land area for a community of tents to live and govern themselves in that area. But again, I don't know that that solves the problem. We need to house people with unconditionally. We need to provide people with drinking water, with clean air to breathe, with a place to void, if you need to go to the restroom, you should have a place to go to the restroom. We allow our dogs to go to the restroom anywhere, and yet we ticket or even take people in jail if they're using the restroom outside, yet there is no facility. And we need to allow people to lay down. I see so many people with swollen legs when they're sitting down. They don't put their feet up because they're afraid of a ticket. In the long run, they're going to end up in the hospital and cause the community more financial burden. And simply that's irreverent of the human being. So the basic things that we need, they need to be covered unconditionally. Housing first, without expectation of being sober, of being clean. We need basic living conditions for all people. This is human. It's a humanitarian issue.
We're going to go now and take one last caller. Don calling us from Eva Beach. Don, thank you for your patience.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, thank you.
First of all, I'd like to say praise the Lord and thank God for a beautiful human being like that Reverend over there and for doing what she's doing. But, you know, a lot of all these homeless people, too, you know, the reason why is because they don't want to live in shelters because they don't want to live by rules and regulations. They want to be running the street, picking up their crack and getting their alcohol and doing whatever they're doing, you know, because there's a lot of homeless shelters here on our island, you know, and I'd like to know also what was her experience or if she ever did have any problems with drug or alcohol addictions, you know, because that plays a large key in a lot of these people being homeless. You know, not only are they, you know, mentally challenged, but a lot of them have drug and alcohol addiction problems too. And they just don't want to live by rules or regulations.
All right, Don, let me get you an answer to that, because we began to touch on that in some part of our conversations earlier in the hour. And yes, you have said that you are out there with those who are doing drugs. Nothing has scared you away from being where you felt you needed to be. But specifically to Don's point that there are those people who just don't want to be involved with any sort of sheltering, that they want to be out and about. As you've traveled the country and traveled the world, is that a larger percent of the population that you see or a very small part of it?
I certainly see it, and there's no hiding it. I think alcoholism, drug addiction is a symptom of larger issues. I think there's drug addiction and in housed people's facilities as well. But what I need to say is that even though I've heard stories, even from people on the streets, I choose this life. If you spend any time with them and hear their stories, at the end, really they're not choosing that. But it's a self-medication. It's a way to provide human dignity to say, I'm choosing to live on the streets. But if we really hear their story at the end, it's not something they have chosen. It's something that they've fallen into.
It's just a story that they're telling the rest of us. I want to thank you so much. This hour has utterly evaporated as we knew that it would. And just to remind everyone that you will be speaking this weekend, and we'll put that up on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. I'll also put it up on my Facebook page, so you can go to either one of those and you can find out where she'll be speaking this weekend. And I want to thank you so much, Reverend Lorenza Andrade Smith, for being here. Thoroughly enjoyable conversation with you. Thank you.
It was a pleasure to be here. Aloha.
Aloha. And I will see you back here tomorrow morning for The Conversation. Meanwhile, have yourselves a good evening. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you tomorrow.